principles of quantum error correction. And in the second one, I'll talk about the principles of fault tolerance. So I'll just go through at the appropriate speed, and we'll quit whenever we have to quit. So let me start by looking at a very simple situation. We've got two qubits. I'll give them names, qubit A and qubit B. They form a two-qubit system, okay? And qubit A, that's the one-qubit system, we all think of as being part of the two-qubit system, qubits A and B. Well, the main theme of today is really that relationship, and that relationship is called a subsystem. Qubit A is a subsystem of the system composed of qubits A and B. Well, let's look at that a little more closely. For starters, let's look at the state space. Well, we all know the state space of a qubit is spanned by ket 0 and ket 1. Fine. We all know the state space of two qubits is spanned by four basis vectors, ket 0, 0, ket 0, 1, ket 1, 0, ket 1, 1. And obviously, there's no obvious relationship between these two, right? It's not a subspace. It's not a subset. Exactly what this is, I don't know. Well, let's look at a different way of looking at a qubit from the point of view of observables, operators. Okay, so what are the operators of qubit A? Well, typical operators are the Pauli matrices, sigma x applied to A, sigma y applied to A, sigma z applied to A, the identity. Typical operators applied to the system composed of the two qubits are, well, any product of two Pauli matrices acting on one and the other qubit. And now, look what happened. The observable algebra, the operator algebra associated with qubit A is actually a subset of the observable algebra associated with qubits A and B. Well, that's very nice, because that sort of makes it a lot clearer in the sense in which the qubit A is a subsystem of qubit A and B. Well, going back to the state spaces, of course, if you learned about how to build the state space of qubits A and B from the state spaces of either qubit, you take the tensor product. So the relationship there is a little bit more hidden, namely the state space of qubit A is a factor in the tensor sense of the state space of qubits A and B. Now, okay. This, if you understand at the end of this hour what a subsystem is, you're well on your way toward understanding error correction. This is really all you need to understand, so I keep repeating that in various situations. So let's look at a particular error control situations. We have the two systems, the one system composed of the two qubits A and B, and we'll take a kind of artificial model of noise acting on these on the system. Namely, we assume the noise is apply any operator, either the identity or one of the Pauli operators acting on qubit B. Okay, now I'll ask you, well, how should I store one qubit worth of quantum information in this system? Well, and the answer is obvious, right? Store it in A. Nothing happens to A. No problem. Easy. That's it. Well, information in A is completely protected. But now, let's look a little bit deeper at what happens. If you look at the states of the joint system consisting of the two qubits, none of those states is protected. They all get messed up by the noise. So this is almost a little bit mysterious from that point of view. But now if we look at the observables, which encapsulate the notion of a subsystem a little better, it's easy to tell, namely the observables, the operators for qubit A, where you store your quantum information, they all commute with operators of the error model. Okay. So this is the basic principle of quantum error correction. Every quantum error correction situation turns out looks exactly like that, except the notion of my qubit subsystem that I use is weird when interpreted in terms of the physical particle supporting it. Okay, now let's look at one more, slightly more complicated situation. So the situation before was one where we had to do absolutely nothing to protect one qubit worth of information. We stick it into A, nothing happens to it, we can take it out, no problem. So let's change our noise model in a little bit so that it affects both qubits. And again, an artificial noise model, either apply the identity or do something like control knot from B to A, followed by bit flip on B. Okay, now this looks weird, but let's think about how to store a qubit worth of information here. Well, we could start with Q qubit B in its zero state. Okay, so that, and whatever information we want on qubit A. Now, if we apply our noise to that, nothing happens to the information in A, right? Because qubit B is in the zero state, the control knot does not do anything to system A when qubit B is in the zero state. The flip afterwards, of course, flips it. So after one error, information is preserved. But after two error, because the flip flipped the state of P, now B is in state one, applying the noise again. Well, now we flip the state of A. In other words, we lose the protection feature. But there's an easy way out of it. All we need to do is, after letting the error happen once, is to reset B before letting the error happen again. Okay. Now, this is the active error control situation. Every error correcting code that you use for active error correction looks exactly like this situation. Okay, so in a sense, I could almost stop here and say, well, we've all learned what we needed to learn, but let's go on anyway. Now, there are a lot of error control methods in quantum mechanics in particular. And you've seen two, passive and active error correction, the typical, prototypical examples of that. Passive error control means you can store your information and not do anything from there on, it'll be saved forever. Now, there's two techniques that I'm not going to talk about that actually predate quantum error correction. One is error suppression done, for example, by refocusing. This is, for those of you who know the spin echo situation, you do an echo to refocus the Hamiltonian that's happening. If you accelerate those refocusing pulses, you can actually control errors induced by a slow-acting noise model. Another control method is systematic error control, and this involves trying to deal with errors in classical control fields you use to manipulate quantum information by cleverly controlling the evolution of those fields so that the parts that you don't like cancel out overall. So neither of these two techniques I'm going to say anything about. The other technique that I will talk about that was our second situation is simply active error control, use what's now called quantum error correction. Now, I'm not going to say much about history or references. This is everything that I'm going to talk about. The good place to look for basic information about this is McIndyke's book. That's my abbreviation for Nielsen and Chuang's textbook, chapter 10 in particular. But just briefly, looking through the history, you see that quantum error correction really was invented around 1995 by Shor and Steen. It went on from there. Shor and Kitaev came up with basic principles of fault tolerance, and those two areas are what I'm going to talk about. Now, since we're talking about robustness, let me point out that this field is clearly a very robust field. In other words, what's nice about it is that there are lots of researchers who've independently come up with complementary ways of doing quantum error correction, different flavors of ideas. But as a result of that, if you erased any two or three papers, you'd find that the basic ideas would still be there, which is great. Some flavors would be missing. And this means this is a minimum distance 3 quantum error correct classical error correcting codec. Okay, so I'm not going to say anything more about history and stuff like that. So when we talk about error control, the first thing to know is what are errors. And I'll talk about a few error models. I'm not going to look at error models in a physics sense, like actually explicitly quantifying them for a while. What I'm going to look at is error models from a combinatorial point of view. What that means is that to define an error model, you say, what are the possible error operators? And usually, what I'll be interested in about those possible error operators is the linear span of them, any linear combination of them. So the best known error model, the Pauli error model, is the one where the basic error operators are Pauli matrices applied to individual qubits, one at a time. And I'll call these the first order errors, or the weight one errors. Now, weight two errors are any product of weight 1 errors. And the reason to start this classification of weight 1 versus weight 2 is because intuitively we expect weight 1 errors to occur first order in time, weight 2 errors occur second order in time, and so on. So when we think about controlling errors, what we should do is first deal with the first order errors, weight 1 errors, and then if we need to, second order errors, and so on. So we have this hierarchy of errors we need to deal with in that order. Higher weights, you just compose the errors. And the whole error model is, of course, then given by unioning all those different weight errors. And let's just generalize this to the general picture. So we see the Pauli operators. That's the identity operator.
Oh, okay.
Okay, yeah, well, it's a blackboard I, actually. But it denotes the identity operator, so. So there again. Okay, so now let's just generalize the picture. An error model.
Why do you call these errors as opposed to just measuring the speed of the
product? Because I'm thinking of it operationally. Namely, something happens, and what happens is described by a linear operator. Okay, that's being applied by not me, but something that's out of my control. So in the general picture, we just take a set of errors, which we just call weight 1, which we make include the identity. And we form weight 2 errors by taking products, weight 3 errors by taking 3 products, and so on. And the span of all these different weight error operators we'll call the error algebra. So it's all errors which could possibly happen. In other words, if you can correct against all of those, then definitely you never have to do anything.
I failed to see the difference between this line and
there is no difference. It's only that here we were specific, and here we are general. Okay? So, and now we're going to get specific again, because in order to simplify examples and things, I'm going to look at a very, very simple error model, the flip error model. So apply a flip to one of your qubits. Well, that's really a classical error model, but we're going to look at quantum states with respect to that classical error model, and furthermore, we assume that the errors act coherently. Like, you know, in your usual communication lines, bit flip happens, but they happen incoherently, namely at the same time the state is measured, so we don't assume that. So, for example, just to make sure we have the picture here right, if you take a state like cat0010 and apply the bit flip to the second bit, you just change that to 1. And it acts in superposition, the last example, the sum of two states, and you bit flip the last of the bits. And you can see it acts coherently. Okay, so one obvious place to store information, if you could, would be to find an eigenspace of all these operators. Like find a subspace, say, of dimension 2, that's fixed, where every vector in it is fixed with eigenvalue 1 by these bit flips. And unfortunately, that doesn't exist. So we have a non-trivial problem here, namely to protect against these types of errors. Now, to talk about error correction, I'll talk about error detection first. And the basic idea behind error detection is to think of a kind of a protocol. And the protocol goes like this. I want to protect, well, not quite protect. I want to detect errors when they happen applied to a state that contains quantum information. So what that means is, do I have a pointer here? Let's try this out. So I have a state, say 1 qubit's worth of quantum information, and what I do first is I encode it in a subspace of a bigger system, say of 4 qubits. Okay, and I'll call that the logical state associated with this state. So just apply unitary transformation. Now what I'll do is I'll let an error happen. Okay, at the end, after the error happened, I'm going to make a measurement. The measurement fails with some probability. If it fails, I just give up, throw up my hands. If it succeeds, I'd like to know that the state is still the same state. Okay. Whenever that measurement succeeds, I want to know that the state put into this sequence of operations comes out again exactly, with no error. So if that's the case, then that error was detected correctly, that is. So So detect it means let error happen, make a measurement. On success of the measurement, the error should not have happened, basically. It didn't happen. So the error only happened if you have a failed measurement there. So let's be specific here. Take an example. Take one of your possible qubit states, and let's encode it in a substate by taking the logical 0 to be ket 0, 0 on two qubits, and the logical 1 to be ket 1, 1. Okay, now what does that mean? If you think about what that measurement has to be, okay, when it succeeds, you have to get the same state out. So basically, what that means, it ought to be a measurement which either projects onto the space of encoded states or onto the complement, and you declare failure if it projects onto the complement. So in this case, that's this projection operator. So you project on the subspace spanned by ket 0, 0 and ket 1, 1. And now we can see what this does. So we take a generic encoded states, alpha ket 0, 0 plus beta ket 1, 1. Suppose no error happens. The measurement, what will happen? It'll of course succeed because it's still in the subspace. Fine, we accept success. So we detected this non-error, so trivially. Let's take a non-trivial situation where a bit flip on the first qubit happens. Start with, okay, so now you see the state of the first qubit changes. And this state now is orthogonal to the subspace associated with that projection operator. In other words, when we make the measurement fails. Okay, we reject the state. Therefore, we find we detected the error. There's no way we could get a wrong state out of this. Do the same thing on the second bit. And of course, again, we'll reject. But now suppose two errors happen. And of course, we end up in the same subspace as we started, but we flip the amplitudes in the superposition. So when we make the measurement, we detect success, but the state is different. So we didn't detect this error correctly. Okay, so now this is a very powerful general principle to think about error detection. Let's define it in general. So a quantum code is how you do error detection. Quantum code is just a subspace of the Hilbert space associated with the system. In the example we just looked at, it was two qubits. It has a projection operator associated with it, and the idea is that when we make the detection measurement, we either project into the code or we project into the complement as an outcome of the measurement. We can also define the code in terms of a logical basis picked in it arbitrarily, logical 0, logical 1, logical 2, and we're looking at superpositions of those. Now here's the definition. The code detects an error exactly if, and I'm going to give three different conditions and its exercises to determine that they're all equivalent, that they can encapsulate the notion I tried to convey in the diagram on the previous page. So the first condition is if you follow the projection operator of the code with an error and then project again, you should get just a multiple of the projection operator. No. Let you think about that for a second. What does it mean in terms of matrices? Well, this is what it means in terms of matrices. So let's change basis of the Hilbert space so that the code's basis vectors appear as the first coordinates. Okay. So equivalent to that condition is that the error in that basis looks like the multiple of the identity matrix in the upper left-hand block. Anything everywhere else. Okay, so what does that mean? If you send a state in the code through here, apply the error, the code space itself is fixed up to a multiple. Something could end up somewhere else, but now if you make the measurement, if your measurement ends up in the code space, you get the same state you put in. If it doesn't end up, well, we reject the state and we're fine. Two other conditions. Here's a nice one. It says that for every encoded state, if you take the inner product, if you take the overlap of the state with the error applied to the state, you get the same scalar multiple associated with the error. And here's one that the classical error correction people like. If you take any pair of states which are orthogonal, then after you apply the error, the result is still orthogonal. So if you apply the error to one, it's still orthogonal to the other. If you know a little bit about classical coding theory and error detection principles there, this is a direct translation of the notion of error detection in the classical case, where different is replaced by the quantum notion of different, which is orthogonal. All right, more definitions. Okay, so a code has minimum distance, at least d, if it detects all errors of weight d minus 1. Okay, that's just the definition. So the code detects every error of weight up to d minus 1, then we know its minimum distance is d. So it's a way of measuring distance in terms of the error model. So for example, we looked at that code for bit flips spanned by cat 00 and cat 11, and now we got some notation. What's its minimum distance? Think about it for a second. What weight errors did it detect? Zero weight, weight 1, but not weight 2. So let's make a definition here. The NKD code for a particular error model. The first N stands for number of qubits that are used to encode the code. Okay, so it's the length of the code in classical coding theory. K is the number of qubits you're encoding, and D is the minimum distance. Okay, and then I use a subscript to denote the error model explicitly. So the code cat 00 cat 11 is a length 2 code for 1 qubit of minimum distance 2, because it didn't detect a pair of bit flips, simultaneous bit flips. So let's do some work here. Let's actually construct a code. And now we can exercise our skills at reading notation like this. We want to construct a code that lives on 3 qubits, that encodes 1 qubit, has minimum distance 3 for bit flip errors. Okay. And let's do it greedily. Let's just start with a random state. Of course, completely random here. Cat 000, let's take that as our logical zero. And now what do we know? In order to be able to detect an error, let's take the classical coding theory's notion of error detection. The other state, the cat 1 logical, needs to be orthogonal to every state you get from this by applying an error. So let's write them down. Cat 0, so no error, 1 bit flip, minimum distance 3, remember. So now we need to detect 2-bit flips, so we need to be orthogonal to these weight 2 vectors too. Well, there's only one left, right? So cat 1, 1. And what we have constructed is the 3-bit repetition code, which works perfectly good as a classical code, but with this error model, immediately becomes a quantum code, because it can encode any quantum state. All right. So now we move on to
generally the case that if you only care about bit flips, then any classical code will do just the same.
Yeah. Right. As long as the bit flips are coherent. Important little difference. Otherwise, we'd be fine. We'd be quantum communicating. Right. All right. So the reason to talk about error detection is because it turns out you can talk about error correction in terms of error detection. And we'll get there. But we start by looking at the error correction process. So the basic protocol here is a little different from the protocol before. It goes like this. We encode, say, 1 qubit worth in a bigger system. Errors happen. Now we actively do something to get rid of errors. I'll call that the recovery operation. It gets rid of errors. More errors happen. We recover again. So it's a repetitive process. We let error happens. We correct, recover. Let error happens, correct. Let error happens, correct. And we go and go on and on and on and on. And of course, we'd like to have the notion that whatever quantum information we stored in this bigger system is protected along the way. Okay, so now we get back to subsystems. Namely, there should be a subsystem notion with respect to which information is always well-defined and unchanged by the errors as they happen and as you recover. Namely, where is the encoded qubit? That's the important question. Basic principle, it's in a subsystem. Okay. So what that means is the observable algebra as associated with the encoded information is always well-defined throughout this process. It may change over time, but it's always well-defined. Okay, so what we'd like to do is pick a point, a repetitive point in time, where it's always the same observable algebra, and look at it. So my choice for where to pick it is after the errors, before recovery. All right, so now let's come back to subsystems. My claim is subsystems is everything. That's all you need to know. Let's define them formally. And this basically just repeats the example I said before. A subsystem is a factor of a subspace of a Hilbert space. So we have a system with a state space associated with it, which you can think of as a Hilbert space. And a subsystem is a factor of a subspace, a factor in the tensor sense. Okay. So how can we specify a subsystem? Well, I can write it formally, right? Hilbert space is isomorphic to S tensor T plus some remaining terms. Okay, so what you see here is that subsystem generalizes both the notion of a subspace and the notion of a 1-qubit as a member of 2-qubits. Because if the T system here is trivial, then it's just a sum of two spaces. It's a regular subspace. And if the R system is trivial, namely empty, then it just falls apart as a product, one system and another. Here's how to do it with observables, so we really recognize it as a subsystem. To define a subsystem of a Hilbert space, any subsystem you want, you just find a star algebra of operators. So what that means is you look for a family of matrices closed under multiplication, closed under Hermitian conjugation, and you make sure that that family is isomorphic to the matrices of a particular dimension, dimension of the subsystem. So isomorphic means I have a linear map from that family of operators to the set of all matrices of a particular dimension, and the linear map preserves multiplication and Hermitian conjugation. So let's look at an example. You should be very familiar with these kinds of states by now. Here's a decomposition that defines as a subsystem, an explicit decomposition. So you see here the Bell states, right? We encountered Bell states yesterday, I hope. All right, so I'm just going to assign them. Say 0 on subsystem S times 0 on subsystem T is the standard Bell state with a plus. And it's 0, 0, plus 1, 1. And 0, 1 changes the sign. 1, 0 is the other Bell state, 0, 1, plus 1, 0. 1, 1 changes the sign. So it's a perfectly legitimate way to try to decompose the Hilbert space by directly corresponding the state vectors. Fine. Well, I claim we can define this in terms of observables. So let me give you the observable. So here's the sigma x observable for the first system, S. It's just the sigma x on 2, for example. And you can see if you apply sigma x on bit 2, which is a bit flip on bit 2, you change the 0, 0 state to the 1, 0 state, the 0, 1 state to the 1, 1 state. So it has the right behavior with respect to this representation. The sigma z observable is the product of the two sigma z's. And again, you can check that it has the right behavior. Well, the product of the two sigma z's measures the parity of the number of 1's in a state in this representation. So the parity of 0, 0, of 0 as 0 t is even. The parity of 1 as 0 t is odd. And so on. So it works perfectly, and if you work out the algebra, you see it's exactly your Pauli algebra, and everything's fine. And I'm claiming that these are completely equivalent ways of defining your subsystem. So I find the using observables directly convenient, but it's always good in mind to have both views. Things tend to become clearer that way. All right, now let's define the idea of a noiseless subsystem with respect to a particular error model. So that notion should be one where if I encode quantum information in that subsystem, and noise happens, the quantum information is unchanged. Noise happens again, it's still unchanged. Noise could happen indefinitely, and it's always unchanged. So subsystem S is noiseless for a particular error model if the error model commutes with the observables. Well, that's almost obvious, right? Like, the expectations of your observables aren't going to change if the errors commute with the observables, up to provided you renormalize the states as you go along the way, of course. But in our case, error models are unitary, so there's no problem. So the expectations of the observables don't change if the errors commute with the observables. And of course, that means whatever information we stored in the system associated with the expectations of that observable is unchanged, which is exactly what we want. So let's look at the example from before again, previous page. The error model we can take as the span of the identity operator, double bit flip, and sign flip on the first qubit. These are just the observables I've wrote down before, and you can check that they commute with the error model. Okay. In other words, this corrects against this error model, and there's the decomposition again. Let me just mention one other physically motivated subsystem that's quite popular, and motivated a lot of this, in fact. Here the error model is a little different. So the errors, the first order errors, are symmetric sums of Pauli matrices, single Pauli matrices. So it's a sum of the sigma x's, the sum of the sigma y's, the sum of the sigma z's. And let's look at a three-spin example. And now, for those of you who had some physics and understand spin stuff, you might realize that these are the spin observables associated with the three-spin system as a whole, which means you can think of the three-qubit system actually in terms of either a spin 3-half particle or a spin 1-half particle, but not really just one, intuitively two, and technically the relationship there is exactly that of a subsystem. So you think of the state space associated with three spins as splitting into the spin 3-half part subspace. So this should be our rest system in our subsystem definition. And another system which has spin 1-half, but actually contains four dimensions, which means it has a noiseless qubit, one which is completely protected against that noise, and a spin 1-half system, which is affected like a spin 1-half system, subject to Pauli matrices. All right, so now back to how to do error correction. Let's see. We have subsystems, various examples. Okay, so the picture here was we repeat the process of letting error happen, recovery, error, recovery. We look at the algebra between errors and recovery, and we want to say, under what circumstances can I be sure that this scheme protects against some set of errors? Well, if you think about what happens in this scheme, we first apply a recovery operator, which basically means in some random way apply one of a number of operators which you've defined. Okay, formally it needs to define a superoperator, but that's not particularly of concern to us right now. And then you follow it by an error, and that combined process should not have changed our quantum information, which means that our information subsystem should be noiseless with respect to that combined process. It should be noiseless with respect to recovery followed by error. So RE commutes with all the observables of my error correcting subsystem. So let's define that a little more specifically. So this actually looks like a special case, but you'll see that it isn't. Namely, an error correcting subsystem is a subsystem, just like before, factor of a subspace, okay, together with a special state on the other part of the subsystem. So the subsystem is S tensor T plus rest. So we have the S system, which is our subsystem, the T system, which goes along with the subsystem. We choose a very special state on the T subsystem. Okay, so here's the decomposition. And the way we're going to use this is to, first step, reject anything in the rest part there. Okay, so this is an error detection procedure. If for some reason your state ends up there, everything's lost, throw up your hands, throw it out. So that's just the measurement. Measure the rest versus the orthogonal complement, which is S times T. Then reset the T subsystem to that special state. Okay, that's simple to do. Then wait, let errors happen, and repeat. Okay, and now we want to know, under what circumstances will this particular process work to correct errors? That's why we're calling it an error-correcting subsystem. Oops. So the error-correcting subsystem corrects a particular error if, okay, now let's look at this. The error applied to a state psi of system S times the special state on system T is equal to the same state on system S, so the information is unchanged, times some other state of system T. Okay. Obviously, the state we're interested in has not changed in this picture. And in fact, we've seen this example before. The very first example in active error control was exactly of this nature. The error, when you start with system B in the special state 0, does not affect qubit A. Okay, so if you now reset again, you can let the error happen, reset again, let the error happen, and the state will never change, the state you're interested in. Okay, so this is a very important definition.
What's the critical significance of the subspace R environment?
Anything that goes in there, you lost. In this error model, nothing can go in there if you always do this alternation. But in reality, high-order errors happen. They eventually throw you out, in which case you've lost, which isn't exactly physical significance. But all right, so let's look at another example here. We had this particular code, the 3-qubit, the code for 1 qubit of length 3 using 3 qubits, minimum distance 3 against the bit flip error model, classical repetition code, span of cat 0 0 0 cat 1 cat 0 0 0 cat 1 1 1. Okay, and now we'd like to have a look at that as a subsystem, so let's do that. And I defined the factorization of space here explicitly. So you see 8 states for the 8 states of a qubit. We've partitioned them between the encoded qubit and the other system. Let's call it the syndrome system, T. Okay. And we labeled those states from 0 to 1, 2, 3, and basically just indexing them by the way the errors change the states we start out with. Okay. And now let's look at this in particular. So first of all, remember this is a minimum distance 3 code, which means it detects any 2-bit flip errors. And I rewrote that here. So this is one of the conditions for error detection. I wrote it as projection onto the code, bit flip, times bit flip daggered. Projection onto the code is always a multiple of the projection operator. Okay, so what I want to do is take as my special state on the syndrome system T the projection onto the zero state for that syndrome. So I can just write it like cat 0 bra 0 for that system. And what you'll see is it projects exactly onto our error detecting code. Okay, now what if I do that? If I now apply a bit flip, if you check, it won't change the state of the encoded system S. So if I start in the 0 for the syndrome state and I apply bit flip, the system we're encoding, the qubit, stays 0 or 1 respectively. So this is an error correcting code for 1-bit flip errors on 3 qubits. And it has this interesting detection property, which turns out is completely general. From correction to detection. So afterwards, we're going to go from detection to correction. So what I want to say is that there's a very close relationship between error detecting codes and error correcting subsystems, and you can know when one exists from the other. So, but for starters, let's consider an error correcting subsystem, which corrects for a particular error model E. And we claim that if we define the code by projecting onto the special state associated with the syndrome system, T, detects every error in E dagger E. Okay, so it's like you have to square the errors, and then you know you detect them by that particular code. Okay, let's go through the argument of why that is. So we need to check the error detection conditions, and we'll do it in the form which said that if we take a state in the code, apply an error, and inner product it with the same original state, that's a number that's independent of the state only dependent on the error. Okay, so let's take the error E dagger D in the square of the error model. And first thing to do is remember, because this is an error correcting subsystem, when we apply D to the state 0 on the syndrome, psi on the system, that only affects the syndrome, not the system, in a specific way. We can do the same thing on the bra part of the expression. And now we can see that the system bra ket, the psi, that just gives us a 1, and we're left with that inner product, which no longer depends on the state of the system that we encoded, only on the E dagger D, the combination of errors. So that's saying that we're detecting the square of the error model. Okay, now let's go the other way. Now we want to say that if that detection condition holds for some error detection code subspace of the Hilbert space, then in fact there's an error correcting subsystem for that same error model. So there exists an error correcting subsystem, and I had to put in a little unitary here in order to make this work. So So what it means is there exists an error correcting code which corrects the error model obtained by first applying a unitary operator, then the error model. Okay, now that shouldn't worry us very much, because remember we have to do a recovery step after the error models happens, and let the error model happen again, then recover, apply that operation. It's easy to insert a unitary operator before we let the errors happen. What that's saying is we correct a bias in the error model which shifts it. And it's probably easy if we just ignore the unitary for now and see what happens. So let's see whether we can prove this. There's actually a quick proof due to Michael Nielsen for this. We look at the error model, we enumerate the errors in it. We start at E0, E1, E2, and so on. And now we look at what it means to detect those errors for the code. What that means is projecting onto code, error model squared, projecting onto code, is a coefficient depending only on the pair of errors times the projection operator. These coefficients form a Hermitian matrix, which means we can change basis of the error model, because we're only interested in the linear span of the error models, to diagonalize that, in fact, make it the identity, because we don't care how we change the basis. After we've done that, let's take the logical state of the code, the subspace. And we now define a product, so a subsystem, by actually writing down the product. So log psi on the encoded system for the error correcting code times the I state of the syndrome system is equal to just apply the error in this new basis to the logical state psi of the original code. Then we do one ortho thing, technicality. We choose a unitary U to change ket psi s times ket 0 t into ket psi l. So that's possible because they're the same dimensional subspaces. There is such a unitary operator. Now we just check what happens if an error is applied in this decomposition of the space after applying the unitary operator. So unitary operator applied to psi s ket 0 t, ket psi s ket 0 t. Well, by definition, this is the error applied to ket psi l. By definition, the error Katz-Zayas times the ith state of the syndrome system, exactly what we need for the ability to correct errors. In other words, if our error correction procedure is reset to zero, apply the unitary operator u, then if errors happen afterwards, the information that we encoded is non-changed. Okay, that's really the basics of quantum error correction. So let's summarize this as some theorems and corollaries. First theorem, given a quantum system, there exists an error-correcting subsystem for an error model E, even only if there exists E squared detecting quantum code. Well, E squared, technically E dagger E. Okay, this is a very important relationship. And it turns out that this really is the same relationship that classical coding theorists know, which says if you have a minimum distance 2D plus 1 code, then it's also a D error correcting code. Minimum distance 2E plus 1 code is an E error correcting code. Works exactly the same for quantum codes. Let's make a minor technical assumption that the first order errors are closed under Hermitian conjugation. If you have a code, an error detecting code of minimum distance 2E plus 1, then there's a corresponding E error correcting subsystem. This is a very nice result, because now it means in order to get good error correcting codes, we're really looking for good error detecting subspaces, quantum codes. And that's kind of easier to think about. Okay. Well, that's the coding theory lingo. If you have a length n, k bit code, minimum distance 2e plus 1, then it is E error correcting. Well, I have 10 minutes left, and I want to just give you the very, very basics of what's known as stabilizer codes, which are a very useful way to build error-correcting codes. They're based on our favorite Pauli matrices, and it's very useful to make some changes of notation to ease writing things down and to avoid having to use labels too often. So capital X is sigma X, capital Y, capital Z, sigma Z, and capital I is the identity operator. Now we can write things like for a bit flip on qubit 2, that's I, X, I. Okay, so explicitly write down each operator, avoids having to put in labels. Another example, sigma Y on 3 times sigma Z on 4 is I, Y, Z. And of course, I'm assuming here that I have 5 qubits to act on. The Pauli group is the product of all these every possible product of Pauli operators, together with a sign of plus minus 1 or plus minus I, if you like. So that's a very nice little group that comes in very handy for quantum error correction. Now, remember our nice repetition code. Now let me point out something. There's a stabilizer, so-called stabilizer of that repetition code. So this is all Pauli operators in that Pauli group, which fix these two states with eigenvalue 1 in this particular case. And you can check, well, the identity operation, of course, fixes it. And ZZI, well, that basically measures the parity in the first 2 qubits. And that's always 1, 0, 1. Well, the eigenvalue is 1. If you apply the operator to both of these states, the state is fixed. IZZZIZ. So it's all even numbers of Z operators. And we can write this as a shorthand as generated by ZZI and IZZ. Namely, if you take the product of those two, you get the third one, and the square of one of them is the identity. So we take all possible products to generate. Okay, now let's look at a particular property. The code detects a bit flip on the middle qubit, of course, and I'll show you how to check that this is so by looking at the stabilizer, and I'll get back to it in the next slide. Check, IXI anti-commutes with ZZI. Okay, so we know it detects because it anti-commutes. Okay, let's go into that a little bit more. First, let's make a definition. So stabilizer code, Pauli code or symplectic code, depending on your flavor of physicist or mathematician. So we're restricting right now to the Pauli group. There's more general stabilizer codes too. A stabilizer code is a common eigenspace of a commutative subgroup of the Pauli group. So collect a bunch of products of Pauli operators, make sure they commute, generate the associated group, and look at a common eigenspace, and that's a stabilizer code. And the reason that's a very useful concept, because it tends to be easy to check what is being detected by such codes. So let's make a quick definition. If N is a stabilizer, then N perp is the set of all Pauli operators that commute with N plus sign. Okay. And now the theorem for stabilizer code is it detects all Pauli operators except those in N perp minus N. So for starters, note that N perp, set of all Pauli operators which commute with N, contains the stabilizer itself, because the stabilizer is assumed to be commutative, everything in there commutes, but it contains more, particularly if the subspaces, the eigenspaces are large, it tends to contain a lot more. And all those more things are exactly those things which you do not detect. Everything outside you detect. So in particular, everything that anti-commutes with an operator in the stabilizer you detect. Well, let's just do one direction of the proof here. Let's define lambda of rho to be the eigenvalue for the particular chosen eigenspace associated with a stabilizer. And check this theorem. Well, if the operator is in the stabilizer, well, because it is a common eigenspace, it acts like the identity times an eigenvalue on that subspace, so we detect it, no problem. Now, suppose it's not in N perp, and let's check that we detect that too. So let's take see, if it's not in N perp, there's something that it anti-commutes with. Let's pick something that it anti-commutes with and just work it out. So let's pick rho as the anti-commuting thing to sigma. Rho ket psi is just the eigenvalue associated with rho times ket psi, because it's a stabilizer. Now we can do rho applied to sigma psi, and what I'm going to claim is that sigma psi is not in that same eigenspace by checking the eigenvalue. Well, it anti-commutes, so it's minus sigma we exchange, pull out the eigenvalue, and clearly it's a different eigenvalue. So we know it's in the orthogonal subspace, one of the orthogonal eigenspaces. So this is a very useful property. And just quickly, to finish things off, let's look at the famous 5-qubit code that corrects any one Pauli operator applied to a qubit. And I'll just give you the stabilizer. We won't try to construct this one. It's a minimum distance 3 code for Pauli errors, which means it corrects one Pauli error if you build the corresponding subsystem. Stabilizer, YZZYI, good to remember. I always forget and have to reconstruct it, which is a big nuisance. But the nice thing about it is you take the first four cyclic permutation, and you get exactly the stabilizer of a code. And you can check the minimum distance property by checking that things up to weight 2 anti-commute with something in the stabilizer. Let's do an example. Let's look at weight 2 Pauli products supported in the first 2 columns. So I just took the stabilizer, wrote them on top of each other, and selected out the first 2 columns. And the critical thing is, if you look at these operators, YZ, IY, YI, ZY, well, those 4 operators generate all possible Pauli products. So if you take a Pauli product supported on the first 2 columns, that's not the identity in the first 2 columns, what are you going to do? You're going to find something. Well, obviously, there's some pair of Pauli operators that it anti-commutes with. It's in the span of these, and the corresponding thing that you get by producting these stabilizer operators will anti-commute with that. And that's very typical of how you check that these codes are good codes. Just one more little quick comment for those of you who want to think more and do some exercises overnight. Another way to look at these things, which makes it easier to think about products of Pauli matrices and so on, is to represent Pauli operators X, Y, U, or the identity by two a 2-bit vector. Okay, so 0, 0 corresponds to the identity. You can make 0, 1 correspond to x, 1, 0 to y, 1, 1 to z. And then if you check your product rules for the Pauli operators, ignoring signs that come in, x times y is a multiple of z, and 0, 1 plus 1, 0 modulo 2 is 1, 1. So if you add those bit vectors modulo 2, you get exactly the right rules for multiplying Pauli operators up to a sign. Okay, and if you use that analogy, classical error correction is all about studying binary codes, or a lot of it is about studying binary codes. This allows you to study stabilizer codes by studying certain classical binary codes. And I'll stop here and have a bit of time for questions.